I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. This week, the Bilawila family have been back in the news. They're Nades and Priya, who came separately to Australia from Sri Lanka in 2012 and 2013. Here they met, married and settled in the Queensland town of Bilawila and had two daughters, Kopika in 2015 and Tanika, known by her friends as Tani, in 2017. A year later, the family was taken from their home by Border Force officials at dawn and have been held in detention ever since. Tani has been the focus of national news this week as she fights pneumonia and a blood infection in a Perth hospital.
I want to thank everybody for their love and good wish. We hope, Tanika.
But how did a three-year-old child get so sick? And will she be sent back to live in isolation in a Christmas Island detention centre when she recovers?
Please help us to get her out of detention and home to Bilawila.
Today, I'm talking to Head of News, Mike Tisha, and Features Editor, Lucy Clark, about the treatment of the Bilawila family and its impact on Australia's immigration policy. It's Friday, the 11th of June. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Gabs.
Morning, Lucy.
Morning, Gabs.
So for the past 2 years, we've been hearing about this Tamil family from Bilawila. For people who don't know, Mike, can you just bring us up to date with who the family from Bilawila is?
So the story goes back from an Australian point of view a long way and has taken many twists and turns. The parents fled Sri Lanka after the civil war, which ended in 2009 in very bloody fashion, with many atrocities committed as the government essentially crushed the Tamil Tigers in the north and east of the country. They both claimed they had a justified fear of persecution because they were Tamils, and in Nadesh's case, because he had links with the Tamil Tigers. Those claims were rejected. In Priya's case, her application was heard whilst on a phone line through an interpreter while she was 8 months pregnant with Tani. She claims that as a result that she was not able to put her case fully to the representative of the immigration department.
And there were problems with the phone line too, right?
Yeah.
Her interpreter kept dropping out of the call.
Yeah. Mm. It sounded, from all accounts, it sounded like not a process that you would want your entire rest of your life to hinge on.
Mm. And she'd been in hospital the day before.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But their claims were rejected, and Kopika, the eldest daughter, her application was assessed in conjunction with the mother, so hers was also rejected. But there is still a claim outstanding for the youngest daughter, Tani, which is still to be determined by the courts. In the middle of that, there have been many dramatic moments. They've twice been removed from flights where being on the verge of deported back to Sri Lanka, and then subsequently have spent the last more than 2 years on Christmas Island alone, essentially, after previously being in detention in Melbourne, from where they were taken from the town of Bilawila in Queensland, where they'd made a life for several years before being threatened with deportation. So it's been a long and tortuous and really, really distressing case that I think has touched a lot of people around Australia and has come to symbolise a lot about Australia's immigration policy.
But the situation in Sri Lanka has changed over time, hasn't it? Like, there's a new government now, and the situation for Tamils is not as safe as it was at one point. Is that right?
Yeah. So in 2019, the Rajapaksa government was elected. This is the family who were the two brothers who were held senior positions in the government at the end of the civil war. And since then, Amnesty International has reported that the human rights situation has deteriorated significantly, and Tamils hold fears for further infringements on their human rights and persecution potentially for people who are associated previously with the Tamil Tigers.
Well, if things have gotten worse, does that change things for the family?
In terms of their immigration status in Australia, no, it doesn't, because once their application is rejected, that is final. There is no way to revisit that.
And they're back in the news this week, Lucy, because the youngest daughter, Tani, is sick. Can you just tell us the sequence of events that led to her being in hospital in Perth?
Yeah, sure. So a couple of weeks ago, Tani became unwell with a temperature. And then over a number of days, her mother is seeking help for her from the IHMS doctors. She's repeatedly told that all her daughter needs is Panadol and Nurofen. There are different opinions from doctors, from a urinary tract infection to a stomach bug. The mother's told she looks fine. She asks for antibiotics for her daughter, is told it's not necessary. But, you know, we're going through day 7, day 8, day 9. Day 11, Tani begins vomiting. And on day 13, she finally goes to hospital. And the following day is airlifted to Perth Children's Hospital, where she's diagnosed with sepsis as a result of untreated pneumonia.
And Mike, has the government defended the medical care given to Tani?
So the most, the clearest comment we've had on this came from Amanda Stoker, the Minister for Women, who said the care available on Christmas Island was, quote, good enough. That seems like a particularly obtuse thing to say when we've had the details of what happened over the past 2 weeks to this three-year-old girl having to be ultimately airlifted to Perth because her pneumonia was undiagnosed, leading to further problems, as we've heard. Their response has also been very confused. There was initially Karen Andrews, the Home Affairs Minister, said there was a prospect that they might be able to apply for resettlement in the US or New Zealand, but this was subsequently clarified, and that is only available to people whose asylum claims have been accepted. Overnight, it's become apparent that the decision on whether the bar should be lifted on her being able to apply for a new visa is actually belongs to Alex Hawke, the Immigration Minister. The court has ruled that he has to consider whether the bar should be lifted to her applying. Some of the commentary around that has been quite odd, saying that Alex Hawke might take a softer line than his predecessor, Peter Dutton, quotes, because he has 4 children under the age of 6, as if the only way you could have empathy for young children or the families who have young children is if you yourself have young children. It seems incredible that someone would not be moved by the plight of a 3, nearly 4-year-old girl who's having a medical episode that requires her to be flown thousands of miles to be treated in hospital. But, you know, there we are.
And Lucy, Tani's sick now, but it's not the first health problem that the two little girls have experienced since they've been held in detention,
no,
is it?
No, not at all. While they've been in detention, they're only allowed outside for half an hour a day. In the early months of detention, they both became vitamin D deficient and prone to repeated infections. Tani's had terrible problems with her teeth when she was 2. They were so rotten that she needed surgery to have them removed. You know, both girls have suffered various vitamin deficiencies in a really severe fashion, as well as lots of other medical issues and behavioural issues, of course, because it's not just the physical impact, it's psychological as well. You know, being, you know, a small child, not being able to understand the situation that they're in. Obviously, they're being traumatised by this, and the medical reports have shown different behavioural disturbances. One of the kids have been biting her own hands repeatedly. Another one has displayed attachment issues and disorganized play. They're not allowed to play with other kids, and they're suffering extreme isolation. You know, they go to school in a police van.
It's such a tragic situation that I think people around Australia are really empathizing with, whether or not they have their own young children.
Yes, all you need is a pulse, really, not a child to be affected by this.
And it's really shining a light on Australia's refugee policies and Australia's attitude to asylum seekers for the past 20 years, really.
Yeah, for sure. And look, go back to Children Overboard, which casts a very long shadow over Australian attitudes to asylum seekers and refugees. The government lied to the Australian people in the weeks leading up to the 2001 election. And we were told that these were people who were willing to sacrifice their own children to get to mainland Australia. And that lie was perpetuated beyond the election, or the re-election of John Howard in November 2001. And those attitudes have stuck. You know, it's been systematic government policy to dehumanize these people. But this family, I think, has really humanized asylum seekers and refugees in a way that I don't think there's any turning back now. You know, the face of people seeking asylum is now this little three-year-old girl in a hospital bed crying and her five-year-old sister trying to comfort her and, you know, try to stop people feeling about people wanting help and needing help.
The government has been very good at keeping the media away from places like Nauru and Manus Island and the real faces of their policies. Do you think, as Lucy says, it's obviously changing community minds, but will it change government policy?
I think the question is whether future policy towards asylum seekers can be separated from what happens to the people who are kind of the remnants of the policy that was enacted at the end of the last Labor government and subsequently by the coalition governments from 2013 onwards. If we can put aside what should happen in the future from what should happen to those people, then I think there are many possibilities for a better outcome for some of those people. And that includes people who are still on Nauru and in PNG, people who on temporary protection visas in Australia, people who've been brought from Nauru or PNG to Australia for medical conditions and are still here in kind of limbo. And obviously this single case, which has attracted the most attention of the Bilawila family. I think people recognise that, well, maybe people recognise that this kind of performative cruelty towards these people who are, through no fault of their own, in a desperate situation and an uncertain situation. They have no real possibility of going back to the countries they fled from in most cases, but they're being denied any possibility except perhaps through going to the US or New Zealand of a future life of any stability. The government is so far at least, is still running the lines that we need to keep treating these people in a cruel fashion to persuade others not to come here. I think that's demonstrably untrue, and they could really make a better deal for the people who are left in the system without really changing their policy on what will happen to any future asylum seekers wanting to come here.
Yeah, is it possible to have a strong border policy and not be, as you say, performatively cruel to people? Because, you know, is it necessary to have Border Force turn up at 5 a.m. and apprehend a family in their home? Is it necessary to give them 10 minutes to pack? Is it necessary to separate them into two vans to take them to the plane that will take them to detention? You know, is it necessary to have them in an empty offshore detention centre, great cost to the Australian taxpayer? Is it necessary to have a five-year-old girl be taken to school in a police van? I mean, these are unnecessary cruelties that, you know, go far, far, far beyond what Karen Andrews said, as this is not a case of being mean. I mean, that is just barely adequate language, really, isn't it?
The language has not changed so far. I mean, Scott Morrison said in relation to Bilawila in the past that we know that if you make the wrong calls on these issues, then you invite tragedy and you invite chaos. And Michaela Cash repeated that again this week when she said, it's the right stance to maintain the hardline policy because we know the consequent, quote, the consequences of blinking. But they obviously feel that there's still political mileage in maintaining this extreme hardline policy. But I wonder if that's the case anymore, given the particular, especially given the circumstances of the Bilawila family, because we know them as people in a way that we don't know many of the other people who've been trapped in Australia's asylum system. Their community supports them. Even quite unlikely figures such as Alan Jones and Barnaby Joyce have said they've contributed to a regional town in a very positive way, and they should be exactly the kind of people we're encouraging to come to Australia. So there is a bit of a difference there. I think there's a possibility that they can soften the rhetoric, that they can change the circumstances of these people without abandoning their what they see as a politically useful hardline border policy.
And Lucy, the minister does have the power to make an exemption for this family, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, of course. So we know the immigration portfolio has this power. It's happened before. over the course of a few years, starting from about 2014, when he was Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton exercised his ministerial prerogative to grant visas on a number of occasions. It was over 4,000 times, and if you calculate that over the period of time, it was at a rate of 3 a day. So we know that the minister has this discretionary power, but when you've got a minister saying who's the consequences of blinking, you know, that all that language is so loaded, isn't it, in terms of, well, we're not going to back down. So that discretionary power, it will be interesting to see if it's used. But community, as Mike says, community support for this particular family is enormous, and I think it's a game changer.
Next, a photo that raises many questions and the shoe that no one asked for. Hopefully you've brought more cheery stories than that terrible tragedy we've just discussed. Mike, what could you not get out of your head this week?
Well, this does seem like going from a very grim story to an extremely trivial and, yeah, light story. I guess we need both. But this week, as most people will know, it was State of Origin, and at 4 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, the New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, posted on social media a picture of herself standing alone in a room watching a TV very far away, holding a can of Diet Coke, and the caption was, "Go New South Wales Blues, preparing for the game, 4 hours still to go." Needless to say, this was followed by a succession of memes putting her in her beanie and blue scarf in many different familiar meme
but positions. But was it really Gladys,
well,
Mike?
I mean, I have questions about this tweet. I don't have answers. It seemed like it might have been a deliberate thing, because it was so memeable and so ridiculous. But then you wonder what the strategy is if they're trying to make the Premier look ridiculous. I don't know. I'm probably too old to answer that question.
Lucy, can you top that?
Yeah, I actually can. I think I'm going to trump you for trivial and light, Mike, because my story I can't get out of my head is from something we had in The Guardian yesterday. There is a picture of a croc. Now, we know that crocs are those incredibly ugly plastic clogs that everyone
beloved wore. Beloved of chefs and surgeons.
Yes,
I think.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely hideous. Made even more hideous.
But very
now.
Practical.
Oh, apparently.
Oh, God, are you a croc devotee, Mike?
Oh, I think you might be. So crocs, apparently Balenciaga has taken the croc and put a stiletto heel on the croc and made it, if possible, even uglier.
Surely it's not meant to be
worn. And extremely impractical.
I don't understand it, really. I mean, and apparently it's going to be costing over £800. So, I mean, really, it's just...
Do they actually sell?
It's the end times.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy and Mike, for joining me today.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Gabs.
This episode was produced by Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Full Story wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great weekend. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.